You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 28th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matt Stoller on Joe Biden's big antitrust gambit. Meanwhile, the White House to require federal workers be vaccinated or subject to repeated testing, as the CDC advises mask wearing in hotspots around the country. Capitol Police testimony at the January 6th hearings yesterday backfoots Republicans. So they quit the unrelated economic disparity and fairness and growth select committee. Of course. Meanwhile, in a runoff, a Republican runoff, Trumpista loses in this special election congressional race. And Daniel Hill, the whistleblower of drone strike intel, sentenced to a 45-month stint in prison. New report from the Human Rights Watch: Israel committed war crimes in the May conflict with Hamas. And the DOJ announces it will not defend Mo Brooks in the January 6th incitement lawsuit he faces. Schumer and Warren reiterate their call for student loan wipeout, debt wipeout, I should say, and a pause on, or I should say, an extension on the loan pause. Renewables became the second most prevalent source of energy in 2020. There's some of your good news for the day. And lastly, a new study shows that black patients significantly undertreated for pain versus white patients. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me as always, Emma Viglin. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing well, Sam. How about you?
Fine.
Meh.
All right.
All right. Well, I'll just say this. NHL free agency just kicked off. So if I have some sort of visceral reaction, I've instructed Bradley to, you know, be on the lookout. I know these are not his typical duties, but there's something that could happen today, and I won't say what it is.
All right. Well, good. I don't know what you're talking about, and so we will just watch with bated breath. At one point, Emma may I guess show signs of tremendous excitement or show signs of just incredible disappointment.
Yep, that's pretty much, you've covered the range. It's a whole gambit.
All right, there you go. There you go. All said and done, I guess. All right.
All right.
Folks, let's move forward with this. Oh, wait a second. Where did I do with my sound sheet now? We got a lot to cover today. Looking forward to having, I've lost my sound sheet. Can you imagine that? Looking forward to having Matt Stoller on the program today to talk about antitrust. It's been something that we've been teeing up. This was an executive order that Joe Biden had made some time ago. And we will go through all of those things. Oh, here it is. In just a moment. In the meantime, there were hearings yesterday on Capitol Hill, the Select Committee hearing on January 6th. You remember, this is the one that the Republicans tried to put Jim Jordan and Jim Banks on. And of course, like Jim Jordan is somebody that you might want to call as a witness, or in fact, in some respects, could arguably be a subject of the committee's investigation.
Well, that's what Liz Cheney was saying yesterday. I think Congressman Jordan may well be a material witness.
So, yeah, I mean, like, there you go. So they
love that little feud, by the way. They can do infighting too.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, again, I want to just, I don't know why I would have to reiterate this if anybody's listened to this program in the past, but a Mary Cheney, I am happy to see the Republicans eat each other, frankly. And I want them, I don't know how, like, physically it happens that they could literally just eat each other, and all that would be left would be, like, you know, a couple of bones from both sides.
Sam Cedar's pro-cannibalism, I guess, on this program today, but that's fine.
That's fine. I'm okay with that. And but nevertheless, it does help from a narrative standpoint to have someone like Cheney on the panel. I find her politics reprehensible in every other facet. But if it makes it difficult for the Republicans to claim that this is a Democratic witch hunt, then fine. However, this is a fascinating theme. I guess we could play this thing with Elise Stefanik. This is a, or maybe we should actually play the Harry Dunn. Let's do that first. This is rather disturbing. Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn describes the way that he was. And remember, you've got Republican lawmakers who said this is basically tourists.
Basically the equivalent of a Capitol tour that you would go on in, you know, seventh grade, that kind of deal.
Exactly. And Harry Dunn describes the vitriol that he heard from January 6th rioters. Here he is addressing the committee.
One woman in a pink MAGA shirt yelled, "You hear that, guys? This nigger voted for Joe Biden." Then the crowd, perhaps around 20 people, joined in screaming, "Boo, fucking nigger." No one had ever, ever called me a nigger while wearing the uniform of a Capitol Police officer. In the days following the attempted insurrection, other Black officers shared with me their own stories of racial abuse on January 6th. One officer told me he had never, and in his entire 40 years of life, been called a nigger to his face, and that streak ended on January 6th. Yet another Black officer later told me he had been confronted by insurrectionists in the Capitol who told him, "Put your gun down and we'll show you what kind of nigger you really are."
You know, obviously, I don't know how surprising that is, although I got to say, I was surprised that that was sort of, I don't know. I guess I don't know why I would be surprised, but I still found it incredibly shocking. This is, you know, and this is this type of racism is not a it is not a federal crime to say those things. It is not a crime to say those things to a anybody, frankly. Nevertheless, the attempts by the Republicans to make this about something other than it was, I think we're going to see this over the course of the testimony that this committee presents. You know, this hearings could have actually been, you know, much less controversial and much more straightforward in trying to find out, like, you know, what was involved in this. There was obviously clearly some timing. There was obviously some coordination. Maybe there was FBI involvement beyond, you know, something that is, you know, just monitoring. And that's important to find out, too. But instead, the Republicans and maybe we'll find out reasons why, decided to make this far more partisan than it need be, at least in terms of the investigation. And this is what they're faced with.
Well, that's what the benefit of this is. I mean, I at the very least, we talk, you know, at the top of the show about how Liz Cheney is publicly saying that Jim Jordan could be a material witness in this case. He is not equipped to be presiding over the commission. He could actually be complicit in it. And that, as a wedge issue in and of itself, is the most important part of this, in my view, in terms of the Democrat strategy. And it's why I support the commission. And also to hear stories like that, right? Because there is value in laying bare what this really was. And it was an insurrection attempt mounted by primarily white supremacist leaning Americans. And that's what was stoked. And when you hear those words, I mean, I'm not particularly moved by the whole, like, I'm in the Capitol Police uniform aspect of it. It's just the, okay, they felt compelled. This was such a mob violence mentality that they really said what they always were thinking about Black people. And, you know, what was one of the drivers of the violence here? So, you know, for that reason alone, and the reason before I said the wedge issue part and the fact that this shows what this really was, those are two reasons in and of themselves why this is worthwhile.
Doesn't quite jibe with the idea of they're just there to protect democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't really, the narrative that they were just on a bit of a, They're just touring the monuments.
They're going on a protecting democracy tour.
They're on a vacation. Yeah, right. It's we all have been there with our civics classes where we screamed the N-word and barreled through and broke glass and tried to trample over people. That's what my DC tour was like when I was in middle school.
They stayed within the velvet ropes.
Yeah, indeed. And,
right.
You know, we'll play later in the program this comment from Elise Stefanik. She is the congresswoman from upstate New York. It is stunning to me in every issue that we're dealing with across the board. The aggrievement from the right is extraordinary. It really is extraordinary. I mean, the idea of how, you know, we're shaming people into getting vaccinations. It is fascinating to watch. And it's fascinating to watch, like, who is carrying that banner as well. But we will get to that later in the program. First, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Matt Stoller will be here to talk about antitrust. Folks, new sponsor on today's show. And, you know, I've been talking to, like, Kyle about how we could integrate this. I'm not quite sure, but this product, I think if you have a small business, would be awesome. Frankly, I know I have very, very little patience with getting responses, regardless of what it is. When I'm dealing with anything that I'm ordering. And Podium basically provides folks like you who may own a small business, may work for like a big business too, but a small local business, basically how to respond to people like me who are, who don't want like sending an email into the ether or leaving a voicemail. Customers have grown to expect a simpler way of doing business, no matter what your product is. And that's why 90,000 local businesses of all sizes have turned to Podium. Doesn't matter whether you have one location or 1,000, Podium can help you stay ahead. It makes business doing as easy as sending a text. It's basically a text-based platform that allows all your employees to text from a single inbox, which offers a smoother experience for all your customers. It can be support. I mean, for instance, I don't want to name any names. We've had a router issue in the office. And it has been very, very frustrating to try and get some service and attention from the people who installed the router. At one point, like a couple of years ago, I spent some real money on a router thing because the whole business is based on the internet. It's been a little bit aggravating to get them to respond. And frankly, it doesn't really do it to me to be on the end and, you know, the reply end of their like internal, I don't know, fix it ticket thing. But the idea that they could send me texts or I could send them texts and just like deal with this problem would have been wonderful. It doesn't matter whether you're answering questions or collecting reviews or scheduling appointments and deliveries or dealing with payment collection. All you have to do is just send a text. Apparently, car dealerships are selling more cars by offering text messaging. One dealer just sold a $50,000 truck in 4 text messages. Home service providers are responding faster and winning more jobs than their competition. I can tell you right now, if my IT situation was based on text, that would be a lot happier. When a homeowner wants to get in touch, they don't have to leave a voicemail. Texting lets you get back in touch faster. Today's customers expect on-demand everything, even from local businesses. You can stay ahead of the competition with Podium. They have free plans for growing businesses, plus all the power growing businesses need to scale. Get started free today at podium.com/majority. That's podium.com/majority. I'm going to send that to the IT guy. That link will be in the podcast and the YouTube description. All right. I want to welcome back to the program Matt Stoller. He is the proprietor of the Substack Big and has had a multitude of jobs over the year. Matt, welcome back to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Joe Biden issues an executive order about 3 weeks ago now, and it is ostensibly basically rolling out, I don't know what you would call it, an antitrust agenda, I guess. And I wanted to get your take on it because, well, let me just broadly ask you this question. You've started to see the personnel, right, that he has put in, and you've started to see these executive orders, or at least, you know, these. Where do you think we are relative to what you would have anticipated or hoped under a Biden administration on the question of antitrust?
Yeah, so this executive order is about dealing with corporate power, generally speaking, and corporate power which usually manifests itself when corporations get too big and control markets. Corporate power increases prices that people pay for things like medicine or various other cable, whatever. The lower wages, because if you have fewer employers, they don't have to bid for your services. They reduce the quality of products and goods. They increase regional inequality. It's a really big problem. Make our food less safe and so on and so forth. So it's this really big problem. And what Biden did is he said, I'm going to have not just the antitrust agencies, which are the agencies that are specifically tasked with the laws that deal with monopolies, the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act, but he's going to have the whole government, right? The Food and Drug Administration, the Health and Human Services, Department of Defense, all of them use whatever legal authority they can to address the problem of corporate power. So where is Biden on this agenda, broadly speaking? I'm surprised he's done, I think, a lot. He's put people that are a lot better than I assumed when he was elected. He was elected and, you know, I did a bunch of interviews to find out how he would govern. And basically what people said is he's more populist than you think. He's not, you know, he's not FDR, but he's, you know, he doesn't trust elites. And he doesn't, you know, he doesn't trust big corporations. He just kind of used them to fundraise from Delaware and then do what he really was interested in, which was foreign policy. So, you know, that was a little bit surprising to hear because his voting record is not great. But I did see him when he was questioning Stephen Breyer in the 90s, just be kind of like, you're too enthralled to economics, which was surprising to see Biden saying that. Biden's picked a bunch of people for the antitrust world. Lina Khan to be the head of the Federal Trade Commission, which is an antitrust enforcer. And now Jonathan Cantor, who's an antitrust lawyer, to run the Department of Justice Antitrust Division. These are well-known foes of concentrated corporate power, particularly big tech, but not limited to big tech. They also have, Lena has done a lot of work on everything from candy consolidation to airlines to pharmaceuticals to seizing chemicals, firms like Monsanto. So it's really surprising that he picked them. And then this executive order, which was authored in many ways by Tim Wu, who's another antitrust scholar who works at the White House, kind of amplifies what he's trying to do. So it's surprising to me, and I think a good sign.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Sam.
Do you want me to interrupt as well?
That'd be helpful.
I was just going to say, not only did Lena Khan get appointed to the FTC, but then she was made chairwoman, which I thought was really, I thought that was a really strong signal.
Yeah, I mean, Lena's 32. She is well known as a progressive, very strong, credentials, sort of probably the world's expert on antitrust law as it relates to Amazon. And, you know, has this incredible track record, was an investigator for the House Antitrust Subcommittee when they did a big research project into Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple. And, you know, her work has reverberated all over the world. So then Biden picks her to be on the FTC, and she gets, you know, she's a progressive, but she gets 21 Republican votes in the Senate for her confirmation because Republicans are fed up with big tech as well. And then Biden moves to make her chair, which is kind of a little surprising and actually suggests that Biden and I think some of the key people around him, like Brian Deese and Ron Klain, Jake Sullivan and Bruce Reed, these are sort of inner circle types. They do think that competition policy is actually foundational and important to what Biden wants to do.
I wanted to ask you about this Jonathan Cantor appointment, because I think for a while, a lot of people who were encouraged by, say, the Lena Khan pick, right, and the fact that she's completely triggered the Wall Street Journal editorial board, they're writing about her on a daily basis, it seems like, they were worried that enforcement wasn't going to be made a priority because that post had been left vacant for quite a while. But there's encouragement given the response, I guess, and what progressives say about Cantor. So what's your take on that?
Right. So Cantor, you know, antitrust is weird because it's not, you know, I'm come from the left, as you guys well know, but it isn't really a left issue. You know, progressives generally ignore it. They don't really care about corporations. It's not that they're for them or anything. It's not really part of their worldview that corporations matter. And on the right, you know, you have a similar dynamic, and now there are debates on both sides about to what extent these are meaningful questions. But Cantor is, you know, some progressives liked him a lot and wanted him to be in this position. But Cantor, unlike Lena, is a well-respected antitrust lawyer who's been doing it for decades. And, you know, he's defended big corporations. He's gone after them both at the FTC and then as a private attorney, and he's on all the like committees with the fancy lawyers. You know, he knows them, so he's got a lot of fans kind of across the spectrum. This is not a sort of going to offend the antitrust establishment the way that the Lena Khan offends the antitrust establishment. But what is, I think, exciting about Jonathan Cantor is that he does have a track record of taking on big tech, and he does see concentration as a foundational political and economic problem. So we're excited about him. And I think that's kind of why you see the progressives who pay attention to the problem of monopoly are excited about him. Conservatives like him too. And, you know, there's a bunch of people across the commercial society who think highly of him.
House cleaning note, just watch your microphone. I think it's a brushing up against your shirt there.
Sorry about that.
No worries. And we should say, I want to just touch on one more sort of like personnel issue as well, but we should say that the part of the reason why we're talking about personnel so much is that to a large extent, and, you know, we've had you on, we've discussed this with you, and we've had Lena Khan on a couple of times, I think back in 2012 and 2014. And
name drop.
Yeah, there we go. And many others talking about. So I think the audience is aware of the shift in antitrust, not so much law, but really just disposition in this country since the Reagan era with Bork, and this change in perspective on what was problematic and what one should do about antitrust at that time. And the laws on the book are more or less there. It really comes down to the disposition of the administration, and we see that reflected in the personnel that they appoint. I was really surprised from a piece on your Substack about Jake Sullivan referring to antitrust as a national security issue, and expand on what he means by that to a certain extent, and then we'll go through what was in that executive order and get a sense of, like, you know, how this stuff is going to be applied.
Right. So this is an important it's an important argument. So there's a debate in national security circles about the size and power of corporations. So some people want, you know, they like big tech because they're like, well, whatever they might be doing domestically, you know, they're our first line of defense against China. You need Facebook to stand up to China. You need Google. You need Amazon, right?
Wait, will you expand on what the reasoning is there?
Well, I think the reasoning would be that these firms, you know, make a lot of money, and then they can use that money to invest in research and development and cybersecurity and, you know, things like that. So that if you want to have innovative, firms that produce, you know, high quality products and services, and then can also defend their products and services in this sort of against cyber attacks and whatnot, you know, then you need to have very large entities that have big security teams, that have big research labs. You know, that's the essential argument behind, you know, the kind of big is beautiful types. So that's the argument. And the other side is people like me and various others who say, no, actually, you know, big is lazy and sloppy. And you can look at things like Boeing, which, you know, monopolized the aerospace industry through mergers and now is a disaster, or Intel, which got lazy because it was a monopoly and focused on pricing games, and, you know, Facebook, which, you know, bought up its competition and then got, you know, sloppy and lazy. And then, you know, TikTok comes in. And so, you know, there's an argument. Our view is that competition really drives innovation and actually drives better and safer products and a safer national security regime. So anyway, this is a long debate. It goes back over 100 years. And in the executive order, one of the statements was that the policy of the U.S. government is that competition, not consolidation, improves our foreign policy position and our national security posture. And we believe we want competition abroad as well as competition domestically. So it was explicitly attacking that idea of the big is beautiful types. That argument is called national champion, the national champion argument. We need our national champions and we need to support them. So the executive order said, we don't believe in that. And then Jake Sullivan, who's the national security advisor, came out and gave a speech at an AI conference and said, competition is really important. Competition is what drives innovation and national security power. And he referred to the executive order as foundational for our national security posture. So that's like, it's a big deal in the kind of bureaucratic circles and the levers that people are pulling, because it indicates that, in fact, the big is beautiful framework, which still has a lot of people who kind of buy into it. Most people at the Pentagon buy into it and various other places. That there's actually the policy regime, the official policy regime of the government is, no, actually, we want more competition.
To what extent does, because I, you know, when I think about what you've focused on over the past, I don't know, half dozen years or so in terms of writing, one of them is specifically is antitrust. The other is supply lines
right,
in terms relative to national security. To what extent do you perceive, and then I want to go in again to the more of the specifics of the executive order, but what, to what extent do you perceive the issue of our of supply lines that are durable or not so durable, and a sort of an economy that is self-sustaining How much does that intersect with the question of antitrust?
Well, it's the whole thing. I mean, you know, you go to a store and like people are having trouble finding, it's not, everyone knows we're having huge trouble with semiconductors, which is why we can't build enough cars anymore. But you know, if you go down the line, we're having shortages across the board in over, you know, a couple hundred forms of medicine, propane tanks, chicken, whatever it is, you know, and the reason is because we don't pay attention to how we make things and move things and buy and sell things. Our political, like, just don't care. And we are effectively an ungoverned nation. There's no government doing anything. And that's been the case for 30, 40 years. So it's like insane the way that policymakers and you know, Democrats or Republicans think about this. They're like, well, let's have the Fed push a button or pull a lever. That's the extent to which they think about the economy. And so now when we have real problems, because there's been a tremendous amount of consolidation, and consolidation thins out supply lines. You know, when you buy, own a factory and you buy a company that owns another factory, you shut one of those factories down, all of a sudden you have less and less resilience, more open to supply chain shocks and whatnot. Now we're in this situation where we don't know anything about the economy. We have a ton of consolidation and we have a bunch of shortages. And then we have a bunch of people in positions of authority who have no idea what they're doing. And you have both political parties. And Sam, this is, I'm not talking about you. I know you care about this. I know your audience is well, you know, versed in this stuff. But most Democrats, most Republicans have no idea that corporations exist. They have no idea that supply chains matter. They have no idea that we don't have a government at this point. It is insane. It is insane. And the premise of anti-monopoly work is that how we structure our businesses, how we structure commerce, is how we do justice. And the fact that we don't even consider structuring of commerce as a part of what justice means is insane. And it leads to all sorts of social and political and national security problems. So it is the same when you're to your original question, which is, do supply chains and shortages and antitrust intersect? It is fundamentally the same thing because it is about what is politics. And we just don't consider the physical trading of stuff part of politics right now. That is crazy. It is crazy. It's hard to convey how crazy it is.
Was that a function of essentially just sort of like the rise of sort of the Chicago school of economics, this notion of laissez-faire, that you don't want the government involved in any type of, you know, perceived central planning. And so therefore we just like we give corporations free rein and they'll take care of it. And as they pursue their best interests, it'll be the best thing for society. I mean, is that essentially an extension of that ideology?
So that sort of that ideology, that ideology is very powerful, and they developed the governing tools to actually instrumentalize the libertarian world that we're living in. But this ideology comes from the left, and that's what the left doesn't want to hear. The counterculture, a lot of the cultural, you know, the attacks on governing institutions as irrelevant and really thinking about our problems in America as resulting from culture, that is fundamentally the ideological framework that underpins libertarianism. And it underpins it on the left and it underpins it on the right. The entire culture war is based on a libertarian understanding of what is politics. And that is a left-wing framework. There are, you know, the right are the ones who kind of develop the tool set. But you talk to any number of Democrats and you bring up antitrust, you bring up monopoly, and they'll just look at you funny. Like, what does that have to do with politics? What does that have to do with anything? And like, that is a deep-rooted ideological framework. It took, you know, a lot of training to get people to where they are now and to not even see what is right in front of them.
Okay, but when you say left, you're talking about essentially like sort of liberal democratic, like sort of mainstream. I mean, I just, you know, I just want to be clear on that terminology.
I'm talking about like John Kenneth Galbraith and Richard Hofstadter and Herbert Marcuse and the kind of the intellectual counter, the intellectual heritage of the counterculture. There was in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s, there were a series of arguments that said that the Vietnam War, the segregation, a progressive conception of national unity and focus on governing institutions was wrong. And they took the arguments about segregation and they took arguments about the Vietnam War and said, which were completely legitimate and right. And they said, let's not reform our institutions to address those problems and build a national consensus around a different way of governing. And let's, you know, move those, let's change the way our markets work so they're fair and equal. They said, no, let's just attack our governing institutions. You know, let's just destroy our governing institutions, right? That's what you see. Like, you don't see anyone saying, you know, let's reform our institutions to make them functional. You just see, let's destroy them because they don't, you know, they don't, we don't like what they're doing. Like, you see this on the right. They're like, let's go after the IRS. Like, let's just defund it. Let's destroy it. Because they were mean to a conservative one time or something like that. And you see it on the left too. Like, I don't see anyone. We had 4 years of Trump when he was doing like terrible things to immigrants. I didn't see anyone put together a coherent plan to reform or restructure ICE because they didn't think about institutional reform. They didn't think about government. They don't care about the actual details of how we run our society. I'm very angry about this, by the way, because I mean, in case it's not obvious,
it comes.
Right, but, I mean, but ICE is outrageous.
Right. But ICE was a institution that was formed in the wake of 9/11. It's hardly, I think, an instrumental governing body that can be equated to, say, the IRS.
That's not true. I mean, ICE was a combobulation of a whole series of other, you know, agencies that got stuffed into a new agency. It was sort of a renaming of, you know, INS. And then they threw in some custom stuff in there, too. And, you know, I'll take your question on and just assume you're right. The premise of the question, I can accept the premise of the question, which is that, you know, it's a new thing. I think one of the things that disturbed me about the about ICE, the debate over ICE, is that there wasn't an attempt to say, okay, we have borders. How are we going to manage these borders? And what are the institutions going to look like to manage those borders? It just was this, we don't want to deal with the problem, right? And that's why you didn't see any, like, they don't have any coherent approach to actually restructuring, you know, ICE, which is like clearly a very scary agency and desperately needs reform. Right. I agree with like the dreamers, and I think we should have a lot more immigration. But fundamentally, we actually need to think about the institutional details, and like the failure to think about institutional details. And this is true in markets. You know, I don't deal with immigration. I don't, you know, but across the board, what I'm just saying is like shipping. We have a huge problem with shipping containers. We have a huge problem with railroads right now. We have a huge problem with oil pipelines, with cybersecurity, with all these parts of our society and our politics, like left-wing politics in particular, just doesn't register. It's just not part of politics. None of that stuff is part of politics.
I mean, I mean, you brought up the IRS. I mean, isn't part of, in fact, the infrastructure deal was essentially a way to get more assets to the IRS and have them just function better. I mean, we have gone through a 4-year period where there was an explicit agenda of attacking the administrative state. And if I understand you correctly, what you're largely saying is that the right has an agenda relative to the administrative state, which is tear it down, and the left, broadly speaking, doesn't have an agenda relative to the administrative state.
I mean, you want to talk about who wrecked the administrative state? It was Bill Clinton,
right?
Like, well, he's the guy that destroyed it, and then Obama destroyed it too, and so did Bush. And so did Trump. But this idea that Trump was attacking the administrative state, you're right about that. And I know that that's something that you think about. But when people were told in 2017, 2018, 2018, Trump is attacking the administrative state, they got very upset about it. They weren't upset that he was doing what, you know, had been happening for decades. They were just upset because somebody told them, here's a new thing that you can be upset about, you know, about Trump doing. And it's like, it's not like they care now whether, you know, Biden is actually changing contracting rules to undo what some of the things that Trump, you know, that Trump did. They don't care. They don't notice. They don't even know what the administrative state is. And so it's like that this is like, you know, I'm saying this, I feel like I'm in a crazy world, right? Where you have really serious problems. Like, you know, like, okay, here's another one. The Green New Deal. The Green New Deal isn't a thing. It is a congressional resolution with a bunch of just vague comments. It's not a thing, right? There is no actual policy roadmap there. And yet people talk about it like it's a thing. That's crazy. That's like crazy talk. Like, I'm not saying we absolutely need a huge project to decarbonize our economy. We need to go through and address problems like how we make steel and how we make cement and electric utilities and all of the rest of it. That's like absolutely essential. And it's very clear that our weather is changing in really, really bad ways. But it's like, how are we in a situation where we're not actually proposing anything? Like, that's crazy. Wait, so anyway,
I don't want to get too bogged down in this aspect of it, because on some level, it seems to me that like, you're talking about a broad problem with the general public and their lack of awareness about any of these sort of
it's not just the broad public. I actually think that this problem is situated on the left. Like the left actively resists thinking about governing institutions as part of politics. Like that's actually
whom though. Like, I mean, you're saying that this is on the right? Like, I mean, is there a Lina Khan coming out of the right? Is there a Tim Wu coming out of the right? Is there
the anti-monopoly movement does have people on the right, but you're right that like the anti-monopoly movement is the only group that is actually thinking about institutional power and actually thinking about like details. You know, there are some people in the student debt world that are doing that. There's a couple of people in the banking world, but like, no, there's, you know, in institutionally, like really there's very few people, but if you look at polling, right. When I'm talking about the politics, if you look at polling, the Republicans are the ones who actually care about market power questions. It's Republicans that care about commerce. And it's frustrating to me because, you know, I'm a Democrat. I don't think the Republican establishment is set up to deal with this at all. But I just think it's totally crazy. Like we're offshoring, you know, personal protective equipment, right? We built up a supply chains here. We are offshoring it once again, because the buyers that buy that stuff are a group of monopolies and they prefer to buy from China for a variety of reasons. And it's like, that to me is an outrageous political scandal. It is not in politics. It's not something that anybody seems to even notice or care about.
I agree. I don't want to spend too much time on the meta thing because we have an audience. Yeah, sure.
I just want to convey the level, like the gravity of the crisis. And also that I think it's rooted in an ideology, right? The ideology that says paying attention to political institutions and governing institutions is not important, right? That's not what politics is. So like what we are trying to do is we're trying to redefine politics to be what these like actual institutional details and market power questions.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my perspective is obviously, you know, warped in that respect because, you know, 200 times a year I'm talking to someone, you know, very often where it's oriented towards that. And maybe that's happening on the right as well. I don't know. I know it's not happening in huge circles on the left. I mean, I share that frustration. That's where
right.
sort of the project here. But
yeah, that's right. And I think it is happening on the right, but in very weird ways that I think, you know, they're different, but like they are having a vibrant conversation about the cattle industry, which is really suffering, you know, pharmaceuticals, you know, the in hospitals, and also, you know, big tech, but they're talking about it in very different ways. And they don't have any institutional capacity to actually address any of these problems.
That I see, I mean, particularly in terms of big tech, it seems to me it's really, they're just mad because they perceive it as a, they perceive it as some type of battle where there's not necessarily a policy prescription by government, but there's really just sort of like threats because they're just trying to, it's almost like a, a less than administrative, but more like a political argument as to which side they should be on, as opposed to like, there's a structural problem with something that this big. I mean, you know, like I see the complaints about censorship and this and that, and it's all about it's being influenced by the CIA or it's being influenced by a, you know, a punitive sense of, you know, from Democrats, or they're mad about this or that. Well, it's like, well, you're not discussing this on a structural level. You're not discussing this on a terms of like what government could do. And to the extent that I see people doing that, they come out of, broadly speaking, the left. But I don't want to get too way down.
I think that's right. I think what you have is a debate on the right between the people that are structuralists and the much larger, the institutional groups, like the Jim Jordans of the world, who are engaged in saying Facebook should be on our side, not their side. Censor their stuff, not our stuff. Yeah. Right. And I think you see that in both political parties. But on the right, you do have people like Ken Buck and various others who are actually like saying, yeah, the business models are the issues. So that debate is happening on both sides, but and I think conservative voters are willing to go in any direction on this. They just want something done. But yeah, that's a huge problem.
If I was a betting man, I had to say, who has more power in the Republican Party, more of a future, the Jim Jordans or the Ken Bucks? I think I would say Jim Jordan. And when I look at the Democrats, I mean, I'm frankly surprised that Biden has gone this far in terms of the personnel. Yeah.
No, I think that's
and
right.
And these E&Os. And so let's talk. We have a little bit of time left to actually talk about the substance of this stuff, which I want people to understand and why it's, you know, it is crucially important. You mentioned like airlines, shipping and rail. Briefly, like what are the implications of what we're going to get that we could get from the Biden administration?
Yeah. So there are certain, I'm not an expert in railroads or shipping, but I do know that they're very consolidated. The top three ocean alliances is basically companies control 80-90% of the shipping market, and they're all foreign. And so what the Federal Maritime Commission regulates that, they have some authority to address the problem. What they're going to do is stop certain unfair charges that shippers are charging basically American exporters. Railroads, something similar, they're charging farmers or shippers extra money based on when there's a lot of consolidation, which there is. And so the Surface Transportation Board, which is the regulator, can stop certain unfair and coercive charges. But there are other more basic things that the executive order does. For example, the executive order asks the FTC to curtail non-compete agreements, which are agreements that workers often have to sign. 30 to 60 million Americans have signed them with their employers saying, I'm not allowed to go and work somewhere else, which is a competitor or a rival to my employer. This pushes down wages. It has all sorts of bad impacts on employment. And so they're saying, we'd like the Federal Trade Commission to actually do a rulemaking to stop that. The executive order also says, we're going to use our authority to start importing certain expensive pharmaceuticals from Canada, or we're asking HHS to take action to reduce the price of pharmaceuticals. It also has a bunch of stuff on meatpacking and meat, the meat market in general. Right now, you can import cattle from abroad, process it here, and call it made in USA or product of USA. And they're saying, no, we're going to redefine made in USA the USDA and the FTC have to do this, to say, no, the cattle has to be raised here for it to be labeled product of USA. And that will restructure our cattle markets and take on the and really curtail some of the power of the big meat packers. And there's about 72 different items, everything from beer consolidation in beer and liquor industry to data rules to transportation and labor and various other things that the order goes into. And so it's a pretty broad order, and I think it'll do a lot, hopefully.
I was stunned to find out how many people are forced to sign a non-compete clause. I mean, like in businesses, I mean, I just, always assumed it was like, oh, it's just the top executives type of situation. Stunned by it, frankly. But structurally speaking, how does that, like, what's to prevent, President Trump in 2025, after he's won, or whoever it is, to say like, oh yeah, no, we're going to flick the switch and they're back on again. I mean, is there any way to generate like sort of, how do you create a durability for a lot of these things that are executive orders or like, completely sort of like regulatory, like, is there a way to do that?
I mean, you win elections. That's what you do, right? Okay. I mean, that's the reality. Like there, you have convinced people to do things. This is why I was like freaking out a little bit before, because it makes me really angry that we have this agenda, which I think is really compelling, and we don't sell it. Our people don't want it and aren't selling it. And so the elections are going to be held on, on grounds of just other things that are not nearly as compelling or useful. And then a lot of this stuff could be rolled back. And it makes me really angry because this, this stuff pulls off the charts. It hits the core populist undercurrent in America. And, our people are just too snobby to actually, stand up to economists and say, actually, the markets don't control everything. There is power in the world. So that's why I was mad. Thank you for letting me get that out. But that's the reality.
Frustration. I mean, believe me. And I also, yeah. I feel like, to a certain extent too, we have a court problem that will and it is also something that I think is broadly ignored.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yesterday, Google, which is already one of the largest firms in the world, increased their revenue by 69%. 69% off of revenue that's in, you want to know why there's fake news? It's because every dollar that Google is getting in is a dollar that's not going to somebody who could be producing real information, right? And so it's like, I guess I just cut you off, but it's like, this is the core problem that we are facing as a society. And we have to really kind of get our hands on it. And we're starting to do that, but we need to do it much faster and much more aggressively to have a chance of sort of saving a coherent society.
I mean, it is hard to communicate to people the sort of like, because so much of this is about the knock-on effects, right? I mean, it is, there's certainly within certain silos as people exist in the country. If I'm a farmer, I understand the implications of a narrow, what might seem like a very narrow rule to some, but it has a direct impact on my livelihood and what happens every day. But, when we talk about the concept of Google, sort of sucking up these ad dollars, and what it does to the sort of the knock-on impact it has for local newspapers or, other news gathering things, it becomes a harder thing to communicate to people. And, I feel that frustration.
I don't think, but if you look at the polling, like 2/3 of Americans want antitrust cases against big tech firms. They want more regulation. It's not a particularly high priority, but they want it. And everybody knows that, like, people are walking around looking at their phones all day. And, anybody with kids is dealing with screen time. Like, this stuff is not hard to communicate. The reason it's Democrats aren't communicating it, and I don't mean all Democrats, but generally speaking, are like our pollsters and our political operatives, is they're snobs. It's really that simple. And like, they were taught that, power is good. And, people with concentrated power are fine, that the markets work, and that if you say that, you know, pricing happens because powerful monopolies like make it happen, that you're an idiot, because everybody knows that the free market makes these things happen. The problem is those are the people who control our political discourse believe that. And so it's like, that's the issue. You talk to normal people and you can, like, everybody knows that their boss has power. Everybody knows that there's power embedded in everything, except somehow Democratic operatives and pollsters. And like, it's super weird. And they all, you know, they went to good colleges and got good grades. And so they were taught, you know, basic economics, which is, you know, a bunch of lies. And that's the problem that we have. This stuff is not hard to sell. It's just that the people that are our salespeople don't want to sell it. We now actually have the product, right? Like Tim Wu and Lina Khan and Jonathan Cantor are delivering the product. It's just that, like, Jennifer Psaki and like the like political operatives in the Democratic Party don't want to sell it because they don't believe in it.
Right. They don't believe in it. I think they also probably feel like it's too, it's just not simply sexy enough. I mean, you know, it's not like there's a tremendous amount of coverage of this in the media.
You look at Republican ads and they talk about this stuff. Like, it's not hard to explain that power, you know, power corrupts. Right.
Well, that's, I guess, some that pairs with what you're saying about it just being them being snobs. They don't feel that they can communicate it effectively when they can.
Well, and they also don't believe power corrupts because they have power.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's a paradox of the liberal state, which is, of course, you need power in the state to make sure that power doesn't corrupt elsewhere. But, you know, like if you look at, you know, what sort of the traditional liberal, you know, civil rights sort of ACLU based framework is, fear of surveillance, not fear of Google or private surveillance. And they kind of like have it backwards. You need a lot more power in the state and you need a lot less power in these private firms. But that's like our whole kind of elite culture on the right and the left is designed to like mask that, even though normal people understand this very well.
Well, Matt, I wish we had more time to go in this, but we can have more time. We'll just have you back on another time. Matt Stoller, the Substack is big. We will put a link to it at majority.fm in the podcast and YouTube description. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. And I appreciate you guys letting me rant a little bit.
Yeah, thanks,
always
Matt.
A pleasure. Love
All
to
right.
see it.
Bye.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Wrap things up. We are back. We are back. Is that right? Good. All right. So Matt is a great thinker, and I wanted to get in a little bit more into the details of these things, but hopefully maybe what we'll do is, you know, we'll have him back and we'll get an update on these things. But there is no doubt. There is no doubt that, broadly speaking, I mean, I think he's a little bit loose with how he uses the terms left and right and you know, that some folks would take issue with. But broadly speaking, from the center leftwards, I'm not as convinced that it's as taken so seriously on the right. But broadly speaking, there is a complete absence of really digging in and understanding the importance of these things to people's everyday lives, or just lack of caring on some level, because there may be some bigger issues at 30,000 feet that are easier to market on some level.
Right, like the moon might fall into Lake Michigan, for instance.
Exactly. I mean, you can get it on both ends of the spectrum, right? I mean, it can range
two sides of the same coin.
Exactly. I don't know what you would call that alliance, but we will talk more about that going forward, as we have in the past. You can always check our archives for more on questions of monopoly and antitrust. If you're watching us on Peacock, we will say goodbye and see you tomorrow. And if you are not watching us on Peacock, we will say hello and
hello.
We'll see you now. That was really was I found fascinating. I wish we had more time. He also had a hard out, or I would have held him over. And we should have him on maybe like on the fun half and just.
No, I always like chatting with him about this or talking to him about this stuff because he is, as you say, a great thinker. Even if I don't agree with some of his characterizations.
I mean, I think when he's there is, it's difficult because there is a, I find anyways, and, you know, again, it's maybe it's not fair to have this conversation, but like there is, and I think you would, you know, maybe agree with some of the, what I'm about to say, is that the center of power within the Democratic Party and within the left, broadly speaking, is uninterested in these questions. And I think also, you know, to some extent for the, you know, sort of like the legit left, right? Like when we talk about actual socialists, let's say, there is not as much interest in this because it is perceived as being a reformation of capitalism. On some level, and there's an allergy to reformation as opposed to a full-on, you know, I don't know, revolution necessarily, but
abolition.
A wholesale a change in our government. So I think there's an allergy in that respect. And then there are others who are just, you know, the moon in Lake Michigan types. Who are just idiots and don't, you know, don't have an ideological issue with this stuff. It's just like, that's all, you know, pointy head stuff.
Boring.
It's boring.
Like those good liars.
And there's also like, you know, there's this sense of it like being, well, that's technocratic. But what Stoller's talking about is not really technocratic. In that sense, it is really more about sort of like making a structural change in how it's not a wholesale change like some would want if they're looking for socialism, but it is a structural change in the relationship between government and society, which includes the economy and includes corporations. And I think to a certain extent, you know, there has been an abandonment of on the broad left of a real skepticism towards corporate power. I mean, the last time we saw it was manifested in the context of like Sanders in 16 talking about corporations impacting elections. But and we're going to take a break right here in a second. But I will say this, that the we saw it in the context of corporations impacting elections. But it was not like we need to inhibit corporations, period. Right. It wasn't. It was just how they can interact with our politics in terms of the expression of them, you know, via money, as opposed to, no, government's job is also to structure the way that corporations behave in the context of our economy. And there, you don't hear that conversation very much. And I think if you are somebody who spends time thinking about those things, I can understand a tremendous amount of frustration about it. I mean, it's like me with judges. Like, I it's such a crucial part of our society and has such massive implications for our everyday lives and any visions of what the future can look like. And it's largely, whatever, we'll deal with it.
On both sides, it's like, you know, we'll deal with it, moon in Lake Michigan, and also, like, Mick Garland's fine, like, that sort of thing, right? Just not...
Right, yeah. Right. And then, on the right, I would agree that there's, let's say, just use the judges as an example. There's far more intensity about the judges, right? But it's not based upon their what they're doing in terms of the administrative state or what they're doing in terms of it is the power of the elect of the right is all cultural, it seems to me. Maybe it's more obscured on the left, and I have a feeling, you know, again, broadly speaking, left, right. I have a feeling that Stoller is painting with a broad brush and also more invested in the left doing this than the right. And it's probably, and it is certainly more of a disappointment to see Democratic leadership not do this than Republican leadership. But I, you know, if you count on the Jim Jordans not to be in power in a Republican administration, I think, you know, it's going to be a little bit depressing. But I don't know. I also think this is generational on some level. It's not, I think, a coincidence that the people he's talking about that have been put into the Biden administration are all younger than both Stoller and I. All right, we're going to take a break and head into the fun half. We will probably continue this conversation, at least to some extent. But before we do, for our free members, today is both a sad day and a happy day. When one door shuts, or at the very least is, you know, partially closed, another door opens. So today we say goodbye. Now, Brendan is still going to be working on the show from afar. He's still going to be doing a lot of our booking and probably also like office supply stuff I may put on his plate. But this is the last time that Brendan, who is rarely speaks on the show, is going to be speaking on the show for now. Who knows? I mean, you know, like you go to school, maybe you drop out and then you're like, what am I going to do now? I'll go back to the Majority Report. Or who knows, but want to say officially goodbye to Brendan on the free half of the show. Brendan, don't be shy. Unmute yourself.
I'm sorry. What, Sam? yeah. Thanks everyone who's watched the show over the past 4 years. It's been absolutely insane at times. And I'm really excited about the opportunity to weaponize all the blackmail I have on Sam for my own monetary gain. So yes. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure working for Sam and getting to know some of the fans. And this has been one of the most, if not the most, you know, meaningful experience I've had working in the media, because I know how, you know, spending time, your free time listening to something and us, you know, being responsible for your free time is like a very valuable thing. And it's something that, you know, it gives me a lot of pride that you guys like to listen to this show. And I hope that, you know, I'm very confident it will continue to be an outstanding podcast, YouTube show moving forward with Bradley at the wheel in the production seat.
And I just want to say, I remember when Brendan came to the show 4 years ago, I turned to Matt and I said, when this guy gets his driver's license, he's going to just leave. And that's what happened.
Also, for the record, everyone, I'm 29 years old. I'm quite old.
People are like, Brendan's 17. What is he going? What is he doing?
He rides his bike to work with like the baseball glove on the handlebars.
Exactly.
Yeah, I got a baseball card in the spokes that makes it sound like a motorcycle.
When Brendan talks about working in the media, all his jobs in the media, he was talking about his paper route. We saw him on his bike with his paper route. And we said, do you want a job in an office? And he was like, what? Are you kidding? I don't even have my license yet. But then he came and he worked for us. And now look at him. He's all grown up. He's got his driver's license. But Brendan has been fantastic. Really made this show significantly better and much, you know, easier for me with all the work that he has done. And like I say, with every door that is sort of like partially closed, we get to open an entire door. The entire door is wide open, and Bradley has stepped through it. Bradley, say hello. I know you've already said hello, but say hello again. You'll be hearing from Bradley more in the future.
I am through the door. The door, it was ajar, and now it is open.
Now, it does sound like we have Bradley in a box.
I am.
We did. That's one of the hazing rituals.
Even when I mute myself? Dang it.
When it's one of the hazing rituals at the show. The first, like, 4 or 5 weeks that you're on the program, you got to do it from inside a cardboard box.
There are air holes.
There you go. We put air holes in.
I'm
going to
shove a Tony Luke sandwich through one of those in a little bit.
One day we'll blow the whistle on your labor practices.
That's right. Well, look, we all voted on the box thing. I mean, it was
part of the union contract.
I got a vote as well. I was outvoted, but I still got one.
It really does sound like you're in a cardboard box. I love it. Maybe they'll never let you out of there. But to be fair, you get to stand. It's not one like you're not cramped, right? I mean, it's we put in like a refrigerator box. He can stand up.
You gave me sizing options at least.
All right, folks, just a reminder, you could support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show and you make the fun half, and you get extra content with the fun half, and you get the free show free of commercials, all those benefits and more is coming. We're going to do an app refresh soon, and we're going to integrate all sorts of different weird stuff. I mean, it's going to be it's crazy. Meantime, Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Tonight on Left Reckoning, we'll be having Ben Spielberg on. He's the founder of 34 Justice and an activist with San Jose Unified. We'll be talking about what should be done with regards to healthcare, what was promised by the Biden administration, what's being done currently, and what we can do about maybe advancing things further than that. So that's tonight, 8 Eastern, Left Reckoning, patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get the post game. And also I'll be talking about my fight with Connor Friedersdorf about Chris Rufo and critical race theory. So check that out tonight, 8 Eastern.
All right. Folks, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back. Back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. can't knock the hustle. Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are black. Black. Africans are back. Back.
Come on. To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.